This is Mayo Clinic Radio, the only show that gives you the chance to ask your questions to Mayo Clinic experts. We'll take you beyond the headlines to explain what developments in medicine mean to you. Join the conversation by phone, Twitter, Facebook, or radio.mayoclinic.org. Now, with this week's program, here are your hosts, Dr. Tom Shives and Tracy McRae.
From the Mayo Clinic, Rochester, Minnesota campus, I'm Dr. Tom Shives.
And I'm Tracy McRae.
Welcome, everyone, to Mayo Clinic Radio on the Mayo Clinic News Network. So, Tracy, you probably noticed we changed our name. We dropped the edge, but we haven't lost our edge. We're now called Mayo Clinic Radio.
And along with that comes a new hashtag for our Twitter friends. That's hashtag Mayo Clinic Radio.
All right. And it used to be just Mayo Radio.
Yeah, we're not going to talk that anymore. It's just Mayo Clinic Radio now.
All right. Perfect. Well, good to see you, Tracy. You know, we've got a full slate of topics and timely health information again this week. A little later in the hour, we'll talk with Dr. Edwards, Brooks Edwards. He is director of transplantation at the Mayo Clinic. And this week, he made an announcement, and it's about what he calls the single most exciting advance in his 35 years at the Mayo Clinic. Can't wait to hear about it.
Yeah, we got to find out more about that. And a push for more research dollars for migraines. We'll hook up with Mayo Scottsdale neurologist, Dr. David Dodick.
And in studio with us this week, from the Mayo Nicotine Dependence Center, Dr. Richard Hurt and Dr. John Ebert. You know, it was 50 years ago, Tracy, and you weren't even born. I think it was 1963. Dr. Luther Terry was the Surgeon General, and they released the first report of the Surgeon General's Advisory Committee on Smoking and Health. Now, I was still in high school, and I guess you could say we really didn't know that smoking was that bad for us. There were a lot of us that were doing it, but we didn't really know until that report 50 years ago, and it came out and it said that smoking is a cause of lung cancer and cancer of the throat or the larynx, that it was a probable cause of lung cancer in women. Of course, we know now that it is. It was the most important cause of chronic bronchitis, and they didn't even mention heart disease and stroke. All that, we learned all about that later.
Yeah, that was 50 years ago. And 25 years ago, the Mayo Clinic opened its Nicotine Dependence Center, and since then, it's helped tens of thousands of people kick the tobacco habit. Today on Mayo Clinic Radio, we'll talk with the director and founder of the Mayo Nicotine Dependence Center, Dr. Richard Hurt, and the associate director of research at Mayo's Nicotine Dependence Center, Dr. John Ebert.
You know, we'll find out how they're celebrating their 25th anniversary, and it probably will not be with a cigarette in a Manhattan. That's the way we used to celebrate. And we'll talk about Dr. Hurt's involvement in the lawsuit. Remember that? It was right here in the state of Minnesota against the big tobacco industry, and we won a lot of money. The medical profession won a lot of money against the tobacco companies, and we'll ask him what happened to all of those dollars. And we'll tell you about Dr. Hurt's latest efforts to take the anti-smoking or the anti-tobacco crusade around the world through an organization that he helped found called Global Bridges. And we'll talk about e-cigarettes. You know, they've become really popular around the country, particularly in the state of Minnesota, because in part of the recent increase in tax on a pack of cigarettes, to which I think is up to about $8
almost a pack. Almost $8 a pack,
in
yes.
In the state of Minnesota. So e-cigarettes have become pretty popular. We'll see what our two guests think about those.
But first, if you suffer...
Oh, no, wait a minute. I forgot to tell you, we're going to talk about how the latest and the best ways to kick the
habit. Okay. Very good. That's probably the most important part of all of it. But first, if you suffer from migraine headaches, you are not alone. 12% of the United States population is afflicted with chronic migraine pain. Last week, neurologist and chair of the Mayo Clinic Headache Program in Arizona, Dr. David Dodick, helped to launch the 36 million migraine campaign, and he now is going to join us to tell us more about it. Good morning, Dr. Dodick.
Good morning. How are you this morning?
Very good. And I should say that you are also the chairperson of the American Migraine Foundation, so you've got your head wrapped around this migraine problem. Tell us, why is it called the 36 Million Migraine Campaign?
Well, it's called the 36 Million Migraine Campaign because there are 36 million approximately migraine sufferers in the United States. So we felt that if we could raise $1 for every sufferer, and I think every sufferer feels that their suffering is worth $1, we would triple the annual NIH budget that is directed towards migraine research. So that's why it's...
So there are 36 million people, 12% of the population suffers from migraine. I'm sort of startled.
Well, what's even more startling is that there are 350 million people across the world who suffer. So this is the third most prevalent medical disorder on the planet, and it happens to be among the most disabling, particularly among women. It's considered to be the fourth most disabling medical disorder among women, and overall, it's the seventh most disabling disorder on the planet. In fact, if you consider all the disability from all neurological diseases, including Parkinson's and Alzheimer's, you know, the big ones, migraine contributes at least 50% of the disability from all neurological disorders. So it's vastly underappreciated, the extent to which people suffer with this.
And the research dollars have not been big enough in the past. What did you say they are currently?
Well, currently it's probably about $60 million a year. And while $60 million may sound like a lot of money, it sounds like a lot of money to me. That's less than 1/20 of 1% of the annual budget. So it's really not enough to sustain a research effort to develop new drugs. In fact, in 7,000 years, if you consider that's how long we've known about migraine, there's only been one drug class that's ever been specifically designed and approved for the treatment of migraine, and that's really not acceptable.
Well, it's interesting you say that you want to develop new drugs for this condition, and I can understand why, but I thought that was sort of up to the drug companies. Why haven't the drug companies come up with better drugs to treat migraines?
Well, that's a very good question. The problem is research. The kind of research that this kind of support would fund is uncovering sort of the molecular pathogenesis of the disease, if you will, an understanding of what's actually happening in the brain, opening up new targets so that drug companies could then go out and identify drugs for those targets. But it's really up to the medical and the scientific community to open up those targets, if you will, to identify the targets so that drug companies can then go out and, you know, make the key, if you will, that fits into those locks. But it's up to the scientists to actually identify the locks. And that's the problem. Drug companies are in the business of identifying locks. They're in the business of making keys for those locks.
So is the main thrust would be to study more, I don't know, the pharmaceutical approach to this, or to find the solution to why people get migraines? Or do they go hand in hand?
Well, they go hand in hand, but it's really, you know, the ultimate kind of research, if you will, is to develop a multi-center registry across the United States so that every academic center in the United States, whenever we see a patient, we systematically collect information from that patient, we upload it into a registry, we collect a tissue sample, so that in a very short period of time, we have hundreds of thousands of samples from patients that have been very accurately sort of what we call phenotyped or characterized. And then you can start to do the kind of genetic research that really gets to the underlying genetic cause of the disease. We can do then work on samples that really identify these targets that I talked about or these blocks. And then we can start to develop more specific drugs that actually target those locks, and indeed ultimately perhaps find a cure if we understand the genetic underpinnings of the disease.
And Dr. Dodick, you think $36 million will do it, or at least give you a good start on it?
Well, you know, when I talk to patients about this campaign, and I say we're trying to raise a dollar for every sufferer, you can imagine the next words that come out of the patient's mouth, well, I'll give you more than a dollar, right?
I was going to say, where can people donate to the $36 million migraine campaign?
They can go to AmericanMigraineFoundation.org, and on that website, there's a button that they'll see that says donate, and they can donate a dollar or whatever they wish to the campaign.
Okay, and the website again is?
It's the AmericanMigraineFoundation.org.
Okay.
Okay, Dr. Dodick.
Very simple.
All right, thanks so much for being with us, and good luck in the campaign. We're all for you.
I appreciate the time.
Thank you.
You're listening to Mayo Clinic Radio. It's time for a short break, but coming up, we'll talk with Dr. Richard Hurt and Dr. John Ebert from the Mayo Nicotine Dependence Center. Plus, myth or matter of fact, smokeless tobacco contains less nicotine than cigarettes. Myth or matter of fact, we'll get the answer coming up.
And right after the news, at the bottom of the hour, we'll take your questions for Drs. Hurt and Ebert at 507-282-1234. Or you can contact us by going to our website, radio.mayoclinic.org, and also tweet us anytime at that new Twitter handle, #MayoClinicRadio. We'll be back right after this.
Wow. Welcome back to Mayo Clinic Radio. Dr. Tom and Tracy, along with this week's guests, both members of the Nicotine Dependence Center, the director and the founder, Dr. Richard Hurt. Dr. Hurt, welcome back to the program. Always good to have you.
Good morning.
And Dr. John Ebert, who is Associate Director of Research at the Nicotine Dependence Center. Dr. Ebert, good to have you too.
Great to be back on the show. Thank you.
So we want to know, how are you celebrating 25 years of helping people kick the habit?
Well, it's been a lot of fun. We had a lot of celebration around the time of our 20th annual conference, which attracts people from all over the world to Rochester in May. So we had balloons, we had speeches, we had all kinds of different things.
Did anybody
things.
Bake a cake? I should have baked a cake.
Yeah, you should have. Or a pie, maybe
yes,
a pie, a rhubarb pie or something. So we had a lot of alumni that came back that used to work with us that are now working other places. We invited all our previous workers to come back. We had a reception at the conference, and so it's been a lot of fun. But there's more rolling out. We'll have more news about things that are going on at the Nicotine Dependence Center in August and September.
So take us back 25 years. You are there at the very beginning. How did this whole ball get rolling?
Well, it's kind of interesting. I was a smoker back when I was in college and medical school and internship and Army and fellowship. I finally stopped smoking in 1975.
Now, you're a big-time smoker, though. I mean, Pall Malls, Humps, Campbells, what were you smoking?
Marlboro and Bel Air.
And what did you smoke?
Marlboro, yeah. The light ones. Yeah, so they're good. They weren't so bad for you, right?
Yeah, right.
Right.
So anyway, I stopped smoking through the smoker's clinic, and two of my heroes were Bud Mattson and Rosalie Ciarto, who were the people that worked at the smoker's clinic. But Dr. Norm Hepper was the founder of the smoker's clinic at Methodist Hospital. And then I went back as a counselor and worked with them in group therapy for the patients, not for them, but for me, to solidify my abstinence from smoking, and got to be known for doing that. I became the medical director of the smoker's clinic. And then one day in the mid-80s, I got two phone calls in the same half day that said, we have a patient in the hospital that has vascular disease that are still smoking. What do we have to offer? And there was nothing that we had to offer. So we got a group of people together to develop the principles for the Nicotine Dependence Center. And we took it to the institution. The institution approved it. And then the rest is history. We opened our doors in April of 1988 and saw our first patients then.
Why'd you quit?
Oh, I stopped smoking dozens of times, sometimes for as long as 30 minutes, sometimes for half a day.
Proving that you just have to keep quitting before it's successful.
You have to keep trying, right. It's not this. Stopping smoking is a process. It doesn't happen automatically. It doesn't happen at one time. It's a process that people have to go through. And I think the group support at the Smoker's Clinic was really key. My wife called me at work one day and she said, I've signed us up, and she signed us up for all sorts of things, you know, like basket weaving and ballroom dancing and so.
Quilting.
I said,
Dance lessons.
What are we signed up for now? Well, we're going to go to the smoker's clinic, and we did, and it was a really great experience. The group support was great. Back then, there were no medications to help, so it was really working through the process, and that was the key for me. The group process was very important.
How many patients have you treated since you opened 25 years ago?
Over 50,000.
No kidding.
Correct.
50,000. And what's the success rate?
Well, it depends on what service they have. So if they come in and they're seen as an outpatient by our counselors, who we call now tobacco treatment specialists, it's around 23% to 27% will stop smoking and maintain that. If they're seen in the hospital, which is a more learnable situation and more intense, then it's 33%. If they come into our residential treatment program, where they're in a special unit for 8 days of very intensive treatment, then the success rate is 52%, 5-2. Mm-hmm. And that's the most intensive thing that's available anywhere in the world.
And they come in 8 days?
8 days. They're admitted on a Friday and dismissed on the following Friday. We run that program about once a month.
And there's a 50-50 chance they'll quit. Forever?
52%. 48, yep. So 52% will stop smoking and maintain it. And these people are usually a little bit tougher because they're more addicted, heavier smokers, more comorbid factors like emphysema and heart disease and things. So that's a really, really good success rate.
And that's where Dr. Ebert comes in because he's one of the addiction specialists. So when did you join the Nicotine Dependence Center, Dr. Ebert?
I started working with Richard in about 2001.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
So and 13 years or so ago.
Yep, that's
and
right.
And how'd you get involved?
So I was interested in really looking at the biggest problems that my patients as a primary care provider were facing, and most of the disease and suffering that I was seeing was related to tobacco use. Mm-hmm. And so I became intrigued because of that.
as an addiction specialist, is that what you spend most of your day working on, is the tobacco addiction?
That's correct.
Okay. You brought some information along about some of the other addictions, but at the Nicotine Dependence Center, that's, of course, tobacco is what you're working on.
Primary focus.
So, Dr. Hurd, tell us also about the new program called Global Bridges. So you're taking this campaign to help people kick the tobacco habit worldwide.
That's correct. And what we've learned over the years at the Nicotine Dependence Center, we have full programs in education and research. Dr. Ebert heads up our research program. But the education part of this is really important. We train tobacco treatment specialists at the clinic. But the idea was that we needed to do that in a more global way. So we started the Global Bridges Project about 3 years ago to build a network of healthcare professionals. They're interested in treating tobacco dependence, but also advocating for tobacco policy change. So we have regional directors in the Middle East, Africa, and Latin America, and Europe. And so we're now beginning to train tens of thousands of healthcare professionals across the globe on what we've learned over the last 25 years at the Nicotine Dependence Center.
And if people want to learn more about that, there's a website for Caring Bridges, isn't there?
Globalbridges.org.
Globalbridges.org. All right. And Dr. Ebert, being a addiction specialist and working on nicotine, obviously, which is the addictive component of tobacco and cigarettes, you also see patients with smokeless tobacco. Smokeless tobacco contains less nicotine than cigarettes, myth or matter of fact?
That would be a myth. And I would say that maybe we could change the question and say smokeless tobacco users are exposed to as much, if not more, nicotine than cigarette smokers.
Is that right?
Yeah.
But they don't get lung cancer, right? They get cancer of the mouth and the tongue.
That's correct.
Jaw, yeah.
And how do you help them get over the addiction?
So we use methods that are similar to the methods that we use for cigarette smokers. The same pharmacotherapies are used. And then we sort of alter the behavioral approaches, and we really concentrate on trying to get over that oral fixation, because a lot of the chewers that we deal with say that when I quit smokeless tobacco, it seemed like there was something missing in my mouth. So we'll use oral replacement products as a way to really focus on getting over that oral fixation.
You say pharmacotherapies.
So the drugs we use are the same drugs that we sort of co-opted from the smoking cessation literature. And we'll use bupropion and varenicline and then all the nicotine replacement therapies to sort of attack the problem in chewers.
Is that like Wellbutrin and Chantix, what I know as Wellbutrin
and
Chantix?
Those would be the trade names, yeah.
Okay. And, yeah. And how much do they help?
So these medications are pretty effective for smokeless tobacco users. You know, it's the rates that we're seeing are comparable to those among cigarette smokers. But I like to think about the way that they're working more. You know, Chantix can help deal with the withdrawal, or varenicline can help deal with the withdrawal. The bupropion helps with some of those cravings and prevents weight gain. So we can attack the problem using these different neuropharmacotherapies.
We got a question on Twitter. And again, that new hashtag is hashtag Mayo Clinic Radio, and it has to do with the research part. The question is, what does comparative effectiveness research say on nicotine replacements for smoking cessation? So how effective is it?
So the quote, the statistics that we like to quote are that if you give someone pharmacotherapy, nicotine replacement therapy, bupropion, you know, well, specifically nicotine replacement therapy doubles your chances of quitting compared to people who don't receive it. So that's something, a statistic or an easy way to remember it. So if you want to quit and you use nicotine replacement, you're twice as likely to be able to than if you don't.
Now, Chantix, the drug that I know that you use a lot, it has a black box warning on it still, doesn't it? I mean, aren't there some potential adverse side effects with that drug?
Well, the adverse side effects are there, but the main ones are nausea and vivid dreams. Those are the things that are clearly associated with that drug. The problem with some of the other reports in the lay press as well as from the FDA is that when you stop smoking, everything changes. Mood changes, weight changes, appetite changes, sleep changes, all sorts of things change. And sometimes the drug gets blamed for some of those things when the reality is it's just stopping smoking. So,
because nicotine is a powerful drug too.
It is. And so the withdrawal symptoms, irritability, anxiety, frustration, change in mood, change in appetite, change in bowel habits, all those things occur. Mm-hmm. And so we like to think about this in a little bit different way, comparing the adverse effects of continued smoking mm-hmm. which kills 60% of the smokers that continue to smoke. Compare that with the potential adverse effects from any of the medications. And when you make that comparison, it's a no-brainer. We use the medications because they work.
I want to quickly ask you about the big tobacco lawsuit. And that was, what, 10 or 15 years ago? How long ago was it?
It's actually this year's big year for us. It's the 20th anniversary of our conference, the 15th anniversary of the Minnesota tobacco trial, and the 25th anniversary for the Nicotine Dependence Center. So it's 15 years ago, Minnesota tobacco trial.
How long were you on the stand that trial?
4.5 days.
Wow.
And there was a big settlement. How many million?
It was over $6.2 billion.
And what happened to all the money?
Oh, boy.
It's all gone, except for about $200 million, which is still with what used to be called MPAT, which is now Clearway, Minnesota. And what happened to the money is the politicians use it to fix the budget.
Wow. So it was supposed to go for the anti-smoking effort, right?
That's correct. In fact, $1 billion is set aside to go to the Minnesota Department of Health for prevention. Wow. Remember Target Market?
Sure.
Target Market was a very successful campaign to prevent young people from starting smoking, but the governor used that money to plug the budget.
You are kidding.
I'm not kidding. And what's even dumber yet is every year there were $200 million coming into the state on an annual basis in perpetuity. And two and a half years ago, yeah, they used that money to plug the budget. And what they did was they sold it as bonds on 40 cents on the dollar. It'd be like taking your Social Security and say, I want to go to Hawaii, but I'm going to give you all my Social Security for the future and use the money now. And unbelievable.
Very disappointing. You're listening to Mayo Clinic Radio. Our guests, Dr. Richard Hurd and Dr. John Ebert from the Mayo Clinic Nicotine Dependence Center. Coming up this week's Health and Medical News with Vivian Williams. And after that, your phone calls, 507-282-1234. Or go to our website, radio.mayoclinic.org, or tweets, hashtag Mayo Clinic Radio.
This is Mayo Clinic Radio on the Mayo Clinic News Network.
Hi, I'm Vivian Williams with a look at headlines from the Mayo Clinic News Network. You've no doubt heard the warnings. Use sunscreen and stay out of the sun to protect yourself from skin cancer. Well, here's some new information about the type of skin cancer called squamous cell carcinoma. Researchers from the Hospital Del Mar Medical Research Institute found a new function of a certain protein that's key to the development of squamous cell carcinoma. The study gives scientists a new tool for the diagnosis of the disease and in the future may lead to new ways to treat this type of skin cancer. Now, every year, over 250,000 new cases of squamous cell carcinoma are diagnosed. It develops in the upper layers of the skin and can be in any part of the body, but it's most common in areas exposed to the sun. Until now, there were no good ways to predict metastasis or the potential for spread in this type of tumor. The aim of the research is to identify therapeutic targets that could be used in the future to fight against skin cancer. The study is in the journal Cancer Cell. And in other news, a new minimally invasive laser-based tool for epilepsy surgery offers a quicker recuperation time for patients. For more than 50 years, the standard effective treatment for medication-resistant epileptic seizures has been open brain surgery. The goal is to remove the small areas of scar tissue where the errant nerve signals begin that can trigger epileptic episodes. The operation, known as a temporal lobectomy, is effective in up to 80% of patients when the seizures are localized. However, the recovery period can be lengthy, involving several days in the hospital and 1 to 3 months of recuperation. Mayo Clinic neurosurgeon Dr. Richard Marsh says a new pinhole laser approach has made dramatic differences for patients. It's less invasive and hospital stays are shorter.
So most patients that in our experience so far have just been in the hospital overnight and have been able to leave the hospital and get basically back to full activity within a matter of days after surgery.
Now, how many times have you found yourself drifting off, daydreaming when you're supposed to be focusing at work, school, or behind the wheel? Well, scientists have created a virtual model of the brain that daydreams like humans do. They hope the model will help them understand why certain parts of the brain work together when a person daydreams or is mentally idle. This, in turn, may one day help doctors better diagnose and treat brain injuries. They say the brain model allows them to test how the structural connections relate to brain function at rest and during tasks, and how brain damage affects brain dynamics and thinking. And that's a look at headlines from the Mayo Clinic News Network. I'm Vivian Williams.
Welcome back to Mayo Clinic Radio. Dr. Tom Shives along with Tracy McRae and this week's guests, both from the Nicotine Dependence Center. We'll get back to Dr. Hurt and Dr. Ebert momentarily, but a story from right here in Rochester, and it's our buddy, Dr. Brooks Edwards.
That's right. In a recent article posted on riot.org, which I do have posted at radio.mayoclinic.org, that is R-Y-O-T.org.
Now, what does that stand for?
It's just the name of their website.
Cool.
Riot.org. The director of the Transplant Center and deputy director of regenerative medicine applications at Mayo Clinic, Dr. Brooks Edwards, declared something to be the single most exciting advance in his 35 years at Mayo.
He's been around a long time.
Yeah, well, let's get this straight from the horse's mouth. Good morning, Dr. Edwards.
Good morning.
Tell us, what is this advance?
Well, it's the whole field of regenerative medicine. The ability to repair and replace and restore failing organs and diseased tissues.
As I was reading this article on riot.org, you said at some point in there, in the future, in the not very distant future, people will not have to wait ever for a kidney. They'll just grow their own new one.
Well, that's our hope, and that's certainly not the reality today. Today, there are more than 120,000 patients waiting for organs across the United States, kidneys, hearts, livers, lungs, pancreas. But many patients don't make it through that wait, and our hope is, through the field of regenerative medicine, we'll be able to either repair one's own failing organ or develop a new organ to replace that through their own tissues.
Is the kidney the closest we are to having that happen?
No, I think there's a lot of work in a variety of areas and a lot of exciting things. The liver has in itself tremendous regenerative powers. The heart, there are a number of exciting studies using cells to restore failing hearts. Pancreas as well. So I think we're going to see different options and different developments for each organ.
I think, didn't you predict, though, that within a decade, this is going to happen?
I did predict that, Tom.
That is pretty exciting.
Well, it is, and that means that we can start dismantling the transplant house.
Well, also...
Well, we're not there yet. So, I think the reality is today we need people to be organ donors and we need to support transplantation. But looking into the future, I think there's going to be a variety of options for patients that we maybe 5-10 years ago wouldn't have even dreamed of.
And the best part about that, of course, you know, you don't have to wait on a list, but also you don't have to take those anti-rejection drugs, which have such hazardous side effects.
Well, the fact is most patients do well on anti-rejection drugs, but they do have side effects. And so if we can restore someone's failing organ with their own tissues, that would certainly be preferable.
Dr. Brooks Edwards, I can see why you're excited about this. Thanks so much for being with us, and
nice
all the
talk
best.
To you. Thank you.
Yep, you bet.
Bye-bye.
All right, our guest, Dr. Richard Hurt, Director of the Nicotine Dependence Center, and Dr. John Ebert, Associate Director of Research at the Nicotine Dependence Center. We're taking your phone calls, 507-282-1234. And don't forget our new, Twitter handle?
Twitter handle,
is that
yes.
What we call it?
That's
Mayo Clinic. Radio.
Yes. Or as Dr. Hurt said, the pound sign. That's what hashtag is.
Okay.
Yes, the pound sign. Mayo Clinic
Radio. He doesn't
Radio.
Like hashtag. He went pound sign.
All right. Now, Bill has been online for quite some time holding. So good morning, Bill. Go right ahead with your question. Welcome to Mayo Clinic Radio.
Thank you. Say, Doctor, I've smoked for over 45 years. I have COPD. I'm on an inhaler now. I believe a lot of that had to do with my smoking. My Nicorette gum, my wife and I both quit. So we quit for 5.5 years now. But we're still on the Nicorette gum. And my question for you is there any long-term effects on the Nicorette gum? I mean, Cindy goes today, she goes, how can we quit that? I said, well, if we quit smoking, we can quit the gum too. I mean, you'd think after so long, you'd think enough would be enough. So... But I just wonder if there's any long-term effects on that.
Yeah, great question, Bill.
Very
Thanks
good.
So much for calling in.
Well, we would like at some point for you to be off of all nicotine products, but if you ask the question, are there any harmful effects from using nicotine gum over the long term? The Lung Health Study, which was a 5-year study, people used nicotine gum over that entire 5-year period who stopped smoking, and there was no adverse effects that we could find.
So what you're saying is, you know, I think people believe that when you smoke, that it's the nicotine that is the component that causes all the problems, the COPD and the lung cancer, et cetera. But that's not true, is it?
That's not true at all. In fact, medicinal nicotine by itself has very little in the way of harmful effects. It's all, for smokers, it's all the other 7,000 chemicals that are in tobacco smoke, over 60 known carcinogens. Nicotine is the addicting part of it all, but it's not causing cancer. It doesn't cause COPD and all those other things.
So you would tell Bill and his wife not to worry so much about it. Try to get off of it if you can, but if you can't, not a big deal.
Well, we would like, I think, for everyone to be off any medication that they don't need. But if the question is, I'm worried about relapsing to smoking if I stop the gum, then we would continue on for a while. But we know that people can taper off the gum, but they have to taper off very slowly over a period of many, many months.
Okay, and you've got the gum, you've got the lozenges now, and also you have that little inhaler, right?
The inhaler and the nasal spray and the patch. So there are 5 nicotine products that we use, and then the other 2 are non-nicotine, both bupropion and varenicline.
All right, and then when we come back after this phone call, because Dave's been waiting a long time, or do you want to go to a tweet?
Okay, well,
whatever.
We'll
I want to talk about e-cigarettes.
That's what these tweets are about, right. Is I wanted to get to is the e-cigarettes. But okay. Dave, why don't you quickly tell us your story? Good morning. Welcome to Mayo Clinic Radio.
Well, many years ago, when I got out of the Army, I went to, we moved to New Jersey. I worked for Colgate-Palmolive, and I attended Rutgers Graduate School. One day, I went to a conference held at the Nassau Tavern in Princeton, New Jersey, sponsored by the American Statistical Association, and one of the major speakers spoke on the subject of cigarette smoking and lung cancer. That was around 1953 or 54.
Wow, 10 years before the Surgeon General's report.
Well, this was back at that time, because I can pinpoint it. We moved back to Minnesota in 1955, so it had to be, I think, 53 or 54.
Mm-hmm. Okay.
And were you a smoker, Dave?
Not really, no. Maybe when somebody has a baby, I smoke a cigar.
Well, thanks for calling in, Dave. We appreciate it.
All right. Yeah. No, isn't that interesting? No cigars anymore. Remember that? You know, Tracy doesn't remember that. But, you know, if you had a baby back in our day, you know, when we were of that age.
Right.
You know, you had cigars.
I've seen
everybody
it in the cartoons,
got a cigar.
And the movies.
Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah.
Yeah, it was comical.
Now, the Twitter questions, a majority of them do have to do with the electronic cigarettes or the e-cigarettes. For instance, Ashley wants to know, are the electronic cigarettes really any better than the real ones? I've heard mixed reviews and stories. Someone else asking about anecdotal reports about the success of e-cigarettes. So, all right, we'll start with you, Dr. Ebert.
So the electronic cigarette is really a nicotine delivery device, and the liquid nicotine is sort of dissolved in or diluted by propylene glycol or vegetable glycerin. And
propylene glycol, what's that?
It's a pharmaceutical diluent, actually. That's the most common diluent used in the electronic cigarettes right now. And it's used in cosmetics, and it's used in fog machines, and it's used as a safe antifreeze. And
put it in your lungs.
So
right.
So but that's the key, then, isn't it, Tracy? So that we don't know, and we're gonna, you know, find out over the next 5 to 10 years what repeated inhalation of propylene glycol is in the lungs. This is like the great human experiment. That's a non-randomized trial of people. We're going to figure out that in 5 to 10 years, if it causes some sort of horrible mesothelioma or lung cancer. We don't know that right now. So that's the danger of these things. We don't know.
It's part of the benefit, if there is one, let's just say that there is, of using e-cigarettes. Okay, number one, you're not smoking anymore. But number two, the oral fixation that you touched on earlier in the program, that can be addressed using an e-cigarette. You're doing everything that you would do with a cigarette.
The internet surveys that have been conducted by some of our colleagues suggest that that's why people are using these things, is to try to quit on their own. And they also think that if they prepare their own electronic cigarette fluid and mixers at home, that it's cheaper than cigarettes. But we don't. There's no data that helps people quit.
So basically what you're saying is you're not certain that e-cigarettes are safe.
That's correct.
Is that correct? But if people want a nicotine substitute and want something that's kind of like a cigarette, you do have, there is a nicotine inhaler out there that's regulated, and you know that there's nicotine in it and just nicotine.
Yeah, the nicotine inhaler, which is a medicinal product, is both safe and effective in helping people to stop smoking.
You don't have that vapor, though, do you?
No, it's pure nicotine, medicinal nicotine, no vapor, no propylene glycol. And the problem with the e-cigarettes is they've not been proven to be either safe or effective. In fact, the meta-analyses of the studies that are out there now show that with the e-cigarette, you don't get any benefit in stopping smoking. And the amount of nicotine that's delivered is no different than the nicotine inhaler. So there's a lot of mythology about this. There's a lot of popularity about it. But we basically do not know very much about it from a scientific standpoint.
Well, I don't quite understand that. Are you saying that the nicotine inhaler, the one that's regulated, the one that you guys use, can help you quit smoking, but the e-cigarette can't?
The data that we have right now, there have been no randomized clinical trials. That's one of the problems with this. There have been no clinical trials to test it against placebo, which would be helpful for us to know. And until that's done, we're not going to recommend to use it for people to stop smoking because it's neither been proven to be safe nor effective in helping people to stop smoking.
So there's no regulation. Why doesn't the FDA regulate e-cigarettes?
Well, they did. They wanted to regulate it as a medicinal product, as a drug delivery device. The e-cigarette companies took them to court, and the court decided that, no, this is not a drug delivery device. This is actually a tobacco product. So they have not figured out how to regulate it as a tobacco product. Now, that's different in other parts of the world.
How can it be a tobacco product when there is no tobacco in it?
Good question. The judge decided that, and the appeals court upheld it, so we're a little bit mystified.
All right, our guest from the Nicotine Dependence Center at the Mayo Clinic, our telephone number 507-282-1234, where these guys are not big fans of the e-cigarette.
See, I'm not even a doctor, and I can tell that doesn't make any sense. That's how dumb that is. Well, if you have a question, you can send us a tweet at hashtag Mayo Clinic Radio or give us a call at 507-282-1234. The addiction angle of this that you study research-wise, it seems like there is constantly research going ongoing about that we have here at the Mayo Clinic. And you said that there is a light smokers research study going on. We should recruit some people for that.
That's right. So one of the things we're seeing when we look at the population of smokers is that we're seeing fewer heavier smokers, you know, over a pack a day, a pack to two, maybe three packs a day are kind of what we think about as heavier smokers. But then there's this population of lighter smokers who smoke 5 to 10 cigarettes a day. And we really have very little knowledge about how to effectively treat these people. So the study we have going on right now is to try to involve those people in a research program where we're going to look at the effectiveness of varenicline or Chantix that we talked about before.
Sure. And how can people sign up for that? What number should they call?
So they should call our research center at 266-1944.
That's 507, yes.
Yeah, 507. If they want treatment, they call 266-1930. If they want research, they call 266-1944.
And how long does a study like that last if smokers want to take part in it?
So we would have them involved for 6 months.
Okay.
All right, Dr. Richard Hurt, let me just ask you, what is it, 20% of the population still smokes?
Actually, it's 18%, and that's the newest data from the CDC. So it's the lowest level that we've ever seen, 18% overall.
The number of people quitting has sort of leveled off, hasn't it? And why? Who's still smoking?
Well,
I mean, can you identify a certain group of patients or people that are still smoking?
Well, unfortunately, a lot of people that are disadvantaged, that don't have a lot of money and have not and can't afford to do this, are the ones that continue to smoke. So the people that are and the other thing has changed, as Dr. Ebert said, is the demographics have changed. We have changing number of smokers, but also we have people smoking fewer cigarettes a day than ever before. So we're trying to figure out how to help all of those people.
How about women? It seems like high school girls more are smoking.
Well, women are kind of equal now with men as far as the prevalence of smoking is concerned. And the most recent data about that from the outcome of it is if you're going to smoke like a man, you're going to die like a man. So women have caught up with men in both lung cancer risk, all-cause mortality, and emphysema risk. They're basically equal now. So it's not safe for anyone to smoke.
Well, congratulations. You women have finally caught up.
Oh, good. Yeah. 507-282-1234. You asked who is still smoking. Bob said he has tried to quit. Good morning, Bob. What's your question?
Yeah. When I have quit, you know, up to a week at a time, I cough up phlegm, you know, continuously as a smoker, and even when I hadn't smoked for a week or so. How long will that continue, or is that going to be there for the rest of my life?
Why is he coughing up phlegm, first of all?
Well, tobacco smoke is what we call a ciliotoxin. It poisons the little hair-like projections on the inside of the lungs, which are sweeping out the phlegm. And so when you stop smoking, they kind of wake up again and they begin sweeping out the phlegm that's been kind of sitting there for a long time. And that takes a few weeks for that to clear up. Drink plenty of fluids and keep at it. The one thing you don't want to do is to start smoking again, because that just paralyzes the little cilia again and stops the coughing and the phlegm production, but it's not gonna help in the long run.
So that coughing and phlegm, is the lungs beginning to repair themselves that quickly?
That's correct.
And it can actually do it as short time frame as an overnight abstinence. They call the smoker's cough is that cough
in the morning. Wow.
Right. And the reason that smokers cough, if I'm correct, is that you've poisoned those cilia, so they are not getting the phlegm and the crud out of your lungs, so you have to cough to get it out.
That's correct.
Bob, we can help you. Now, give him that number again, because we want to see you stop, Bob.
Right, we do. And so that number that he should call is area code 507-266-1930.
Okay, and my question is, eventually, if I quit smoking, I should see that phlegm disappear.
That's correct.
Okay, thank you much.
All right, thanks for calling in, Bob. And a final question, a tweet, let's hear about nicotine and addictions. Are addictions fatal in and of themselves? That's an interesting question from Doreen. But the addiction part, I guess, if you can't get off of any anything, then you are. It is going to be fatal.
So I think you have to look at any sort of addictive process in the context of what the substances they're taking and the social constructs around that and the things that are promoting that behavior. So, for example, gambling by definition does not kill you.
Sure.
It's a process addiction, but it destroys your finances and ruins your relationships with people around you. So really it's not the addictive thing that's the danger. It's the social and personal impact of that addiction.
All right, we're just about out of time. Dr. Richard Hurt, Dr. John Ebert, give us the telephone number once more. Anybody out there in the audience who's still smoking, I suspect they want to quit. How can they do it? What's the number?
So they call us at 507-266-1930.
1930. You've been listening to Mayo Clinic Radio on the Mayo Clinic News Network. Coming up, we'll tell you about next week's program. Stay with us. Welcome back. Next week on Mayo Clinic Radio, we'll talk with heart specialist Dr. Chet Rehal. Now, he is the director of the Mayo Clinic Cardiac Cath Lab. And, you know, if you have blocked arteries to your heart, mm-hmm. You go to this lab and they put some dye in your system and they can figure out if you have a blockage, how much the blockage is, and then they can fix it. It's absolutely incredible.
Just like that.
Yeah, it's that easy. But the problem is you really don't want to have to go there.
No.
But we'll tell you how they do it. And, you know, they put a little balloon in there and then they blow up the artery so they expand it and improve the blood flow. And then they put a stent in there, like the spring inside of a pen.
Sure.
And then that holds it open. It's an incredible process. And we'll also talk about other treatment options, medical options, and the old CABG, you know, the coronary bypass operation. See if they still do that.
Well, and he was all excited to tell you about a new thing that had to do with valves or something that he's going to talk about.
Exactly right. And what they can do now is they can actually fix or replace the heart valves without cracking your chest. Huh. It's going to be an incredible show. And we'll also tell you how to stay out of the cardiac cath lab next week on Mayo Clinic Radio.
Can I just say I've never liked the term cracking your chest? Well, I don't think that sounds good. Right. Well, we hope you'll join us. For more information on topics discussed on this program, please visit our website, radio.mayoclinic.org, where you can access a podcast of today's program, as well as previously aired episodes, or visit us at mayoclinic.com, where over 3,000 physicians, scientists, and researchers from Mayo Clinic share their expertise to better manage your health.
You've been listening to Mayo Clinic Radio on the Mayo Clinic News Network. Our senior producer, Ron Petrovich, our associate producer and phone screener, Audrey Castletine. Our theme music was written and performed by Chip Davis, and at the controls over there, Rich Peterson. For Mayo Clinic Radio, I'm Dr. Tom Shives.
And I'm Tracy McRae.
Thanks so much for being with us.
Any medical information conveyed during this program is not intended as a substitute for personal medical advice, and you should not take any action before consulting a healthcare professional. For more information, please go to our website, radio.mayoclinic.org. Please join us each week on this station for more of the medical information you want from Mayo Clinic specialists who know.